Thanks, Ros. Good evening. My name's Ralph. I'm an addict. And, well, here I am in big London. And being in this area of London takes me back a long, long time, probably to 1964, 1965. I was in a club in Wardle Street, just round the corner, and The Who were playing, and Roger Daltrey was singing, "I Hope I Die Before I Get Old." And I really identified with those words. Life was not enjoyable. I was a baby addict. I was probably, I guess, 17, 18 years of age. I did have a horrendous childhood. And today I feel free enough and okay enough to say that. As a child, I was abused sexually, I was abused physically, I was abused emotionally. And I made a decision. I can remember perhaps being seven, 8 years of age, being yanked up onto a stage to be caned by a headmaster. And I made a decision that people might hurt me, but they would never, ever know it. And it was a decision to zip myself up. I became a zipped up guy. I made a decision to present as being strong and not to feel. And of course, drugs helped in that process. You know, listening to Jennifer, I'm a recovering Roman Catholic too. There's a lot of us about. Yeah, I became this zipped up teenager. I was an angry little fucker. You know, I was like, you know those Tasmanian devils? I was one of them. And, you know, and I had to do stuff to get attention. The school inspector came round in his shiny white car. Who smeared dog shit all over it? I got lots of attention. I've got lots of negative attention. My drug use went on for 28 years. And the same progression that I've heard time and time again in these rooms. I went to the prisons. I spent 4.5 years in prison. I went to the psychiatric hospitals and I learned to do that. So I fitted in. I did lots of geographicals. I would find myself, I'd find myself in India, living in an ashram, getting up at 4 o'clock in the morning to meditate by the Ganges. However, I would swallow, before I went meditating, I would swallow a ball of opium. So it wasn't meditating, it was gouging. I would find myself in Afghanistan and find out that you got the equivalent of £7 for blood, knowing that I just had hepatitis and not caring. And, you know, fight that they only wanted 30 people's worth of blood, and you know, and there was, you know, there was maybe 200 guys there, most of them armed, the guys out of the Khyber Pass with old blunderbuss. But I managed to sell my blood and get my drugs. When I was in prison, I managed to always get a few spots. You know, I found ways and means to use. So I found myself age 42. I had a doctor in Streatham, a wonderful doctor. He'd give me a prescription for myself, for my girlfriend, for my mother, my father, and my cat. And he was retiring. I had a great big abscess on my bum. Life was not good. I decided for the first time ever, I didn't know what else to do. I went into a detox unit, and they suggested that I went to Narcotics Anonymous. There were a couple of people coming in to talk about Narcotics Anonymous. And so I went along, and I went along with contempt prior to investigation. They were wearing suits. Well, suits, clean clothes anyway. Yeah. They didn't look like addicts. They were talking about going on a holiday. All alien concepts to me. I didn't listen. I didn't disrupt, but I didn't take anything on board. And it was only later that I discovered those two guys cared about more about me than I cared about myself at that time. And while I was there, they suggested that we went. Well, I had a green bus, they took us to a meeting in Camberwell. And I went on the bus because I wanted to see if some of my pals were still on the pavement. I was looking for a way out. And I took a look at Narcotics Anonymous. I didn't get a sponsor. Didn't do any service. I was zipped up. I wasn't going to tell you who I was. I wasn't going to tell you anything about me. So I didn't share. And I waited for it to happen. I waited for recovery to happen through osmosis. It did happen. Relapse happened. Those of you that have had the experience of a little bit of recovery and a lot of drugs will, like me, know what hell on earth is like, because I was using again, and I was using in a way that was so destructive. A good day I would wake up at 10 o'clock in the morning and I'd be comatose by 11. I just didn't want to experience life. I was in Brighton at that time. I ended up in hospital while I was covered in abscesses. I had septicemia. They were debating for 48 hours whether they needed to amputate my left leg. My pal was bringing me to Mazapan, which I was shooting up in the right side of my groin. And I would, I went to a unit. It wasn't a treatment centre. It was a safe house at a large portion of Humble Pie, and came back to Narcotics Anonymous. And I did all the things I didn't do the first time. I got a sponsor. I got a sponsor for the wrong reason. I got a sponsor because he was a bit of a hippie. He told me it was okay to have sex, but not to fall in love. And some years on, I don't know what the hell he still don't know what the hell he was talking about. I'm around, he's not. Then I got another sponsor. It took me 18 months to work out I'd chosen my father. I'd chosen a man that wasn't available to me. You know, it's very hard to recover when you're only talking to an answer phone. It took me 18 months to work that one out, because, you know, it was familiar. The word familiar comes from the family. I'd learnt it in the family. Then I got another sponsor who decided to go touring China, and he went travelling, and he fostered me out, and he fostered me to his sponsor, and I'd been fostered as a child, so again that felt very familiar. My self-esteem was such that I wasn't going to argue. Yeah, I'll go along with it. And I got the sponsor that I've still got today. I've had that sponsor for 13 years. And I love him. I love him so much. He knows as much about me as I know about myself. He doesn't tell me what to do. I'm lost for words, and I'm not usually lost for words. Just to say that he's the person in my life that has faith in me on the days I don't have faith in myself. And, you know, this recovery has been a trip. No 2 days have been the same. Jennifer was talking about the steps. When I first came to Narcotics Anonymous, saw the steps on the, you know, up on the wall. I'm a recovering Roman Catholic. Didn't like the word God. Heard people talking about hitting their knees. I can't do that. I can't do it. I won't do it. The moment I kneel, what comes up is an old guy with a beard that's very, very punitive. I made the decision to move closer to a loving spirit. That's my third step. And I find that loving spirit in these rooms. My belief is that God, I can use the word God, God and myself are co-creators of my life. You know, I am powerless, but I'm not helpless. You know, early recovery, I used powerlessness as a cop-out. You know, it's a way of divorcing myself from responsibility for my life. You know, I have choices. You know, right now, I've chosen to be in a Narcotics Anonymous meeting. Don't have to be here, nor do any of you. You're here because you want to be. And that's the same decision, in my view. I arrived in Narcotics Anonymous full of shame. I couldn't look you in the eye, because if you saw in my eyes, you'd see my soul, and my soul was dirty. That's how I felt. I recognised people by their trainers. I wasn't able to get up in the middle of the meeting to go for a pee, because if I did, you'd look at me. And if you saw me, you'd despise me, in my view. And it's been a process of learning to love myself. Firstly, letting you guys love me and care for me. I had to learn to listen and listen to learn. Picking up on what Jennifer was talking about, you know, where I came from, I was either always wrong or always right. And going back some years, there was a lot of consciences going around to remove the word God from the 12 Steps of Narcotics Anonymous, and just to replace it with higher power. And I was very much in favour of that. However, it wasn't the decision of Narcotics Anonymous worldwide. And at that point, I was left with a choice. And it's a choice that I'm left with on a daily basis, perhaps on an hourly basis sometimes. And the choice is, do I want to be right or do I want to be happy? Because, very often I can't be both. Throughout my using, throughout early recovery, I needed to be right, which meant other people had to be wrong. Today I choose to be happy. I've learned that I don't have to fight every battle. I've learned to choose my battles. I've done service throughout my recovery. Apart from when I was 5 years clean. When I was 5 years clean, I'd done enough. I did a chair a couple of Fridays ago, and I was talking about how I'd gone through three stages in my recovery. The first stage was the sprinter. I was the sprinter. I was in such a hurry to get away from active addiction. I was running. I went through the steps very quickly. I went through 12 steps in 12 months, superficially. And having said that, I've only ever written one step one, and it's rather twee. It's like a kiddie's kindergarten writing, but it's good enough. It's been good enough to keep me clean. And then I went through the marathon runner stage, where I was, life was kind of like this. At the time I was working in the treatment centre. I was working Monday to Friday, 9 to 5. Then at 5:30 I'd jump in a car and I'd zoom off and spend the weekend at the region, perhaps in Glasgow, perhaps in Plymouth, and I don't know, some of you may have been to the region. It's rather like a weekend version of the ASC that goes on all weekend, and everybody's got to be right. And certainly that was my experience. And everybody's got an opinion, and you know, opinions are like bums. We've all got one, and so that's what life was like, you know. Recovery became a chore, and I will use the word should. It shouldn't. Recovery shouldn't be a chore. Active addiction's a chore. There was a day where my sponsor banned me from doing committee service. No more committee service. You're turning into a control freak, Ralph. And God bless him. And, you know, recently I've just felt like in recovery, I'm strolling. I know it won't always be like that. And got 10 minutes left. I was talking at the beginning of this chair about hope I die before I get old. Well, in a month's time, I'm 60. And that's a weird concept, isn't it? A 60-year-old addict. Who ever heard of such a thing? I'm turning into an old person in recovery. And I'm going to go and spend a week or 8 days in Portugal, and I've worked out a lovely way of working step 10. It happens where the sea hits the beach, and I walk along just, you know, that part where the tide hits the beach. And I reflect, and I've done it a few times in recovery. And I want to reflect on where now. It's a transition. I work in a very demanding job. I listen to horror stories on a daily basis. You know, people come to see me and they talk about their childhood abuse, they talk about their depression, they talk about their pain, and I've been doing it for a long time. I don't want to stop, but perhaps I want to assess how much energy I've got. I sponsor a lot of people in Brighton. You know, I want to take a look at how much I can give, because what I've learned is if I'm giving more than I'm able, I become resentful. And the moment I become resentful, it ceases to be service. You know, I find that I've got two kinds of sponsees. I've got those that check in and those that check out. And the ones that, you know, I'm not saying they need to phone me up and say, Ralph, I've just breathed in, is it okay to breathe out? But, you know, those that check in tend to self-sponsor. And, you know, I can't do too much. You know, somebody phones me up and says, perhaps well, the doctor suggested I take this medication, and I swallowed it, and I wondered what you think. I can't do a lot then. You know, my recovery, what I've learned to do is, earlier this year, I had shingles, and I saw the doctor, and he said, well, you do need to take amitriptyline, which is a mood and mind, you know, a minuscule amount for me. But it was mind and mood altering. I didn't take it and then phone my sponsor. I got a prescription. I phoned my sponsor and I said, you know, the choice is I take this medication or for the rest of my life I'm going to have serious damage to my nerve endings. It was on my face. You know, I'm going to end up... the nerve endings on my face are going to be... And he said, take it. And I went to a meeting and I told you guys I was taking it. And I didn't have, you know, and I finished the prescription. I didn't have to pick up anything else. Well, yeah, I'm going to be 60. It's taken me many years to feel this young. I came to Narcotics Anonymous carrying a black bag, bin liner. You know, I was dressed in clothes that were covered in blood and pus. As I said, I couldn't look you in the eye. My first prayers were, I asked to have a life that was worth living, and I've got that and more. Through coming to Narcotics Anonymous, working with a sponsor, doing service, I do service in the best meeting in the UK, and I hope every single one of you that does service can say the same, because if I do service, my goal is to make it the best meeting. I make the tea, and I'm not saying I make the tea because I want to seem very humble. It's the first time I've ever made the tea. We have chocolate biscuits. And it's a topic meeting, and it's in Brighton. It's at the Millwood Centre, and it's in the middle of a block of flats where there's lots and lots of using addicts. So I've done service. I've worked the steps, and one of the things I was unable to do, this zipped up guy was unable to do, was cry. I didn't cry for 35 years. And if you don't have your tears, you can't have your rainbows. And there was no rainbows in my life. It took me 4.5 years in recovery to cry. It took me getting into a relationship and losing the relationship. It took me sat there. I chain smoked 40 cigarettes to keep the feelings down. I got hold of a pair of nail scissors and looked at them and debated ripping my guts with them to displace the pain I was feeling, and the dam broke, and I let out a howl like a wounded animal, and that lake of frozen tears, all those tears that I hadn't shed, started to melt. and I rejoined the human race, or I joined the human race for the first time. And I cried today. There's three kinds of tears. There's tears of rage, there's tears of sadness, and there's tears of joy. And got a call from a woman that our lives have crossed. And a year ago, she was getting curling tongs, you know, that women use, some guys use to curl their hair. And she was putting them on her face. And that's how much self-hatred she had. And she stopped doing it. And she phoned to say that she just got a place on at Brighton University to study to be a lawyer. And I cried because I heard the voice of a miracle. You know, miracles happen in these rooms. They happen every day. I'm a miracle, you're a miracle. Every addict that's not using is a miracle. And we know what we are. Just to finish, I've only met recently one social user of Big Brother. I've only met one person that can watch Big Brother now and again. The whole nation is divided. You're either addicted to it, like me, or you don't watch that fucking shit, do you? Anyway, last night I saw a woman trying to explain what Jennifer was talking about. You know, that big ego kind of covering the low self-esteem. In here, we get, you know, we know, I know, you know, I'm sure you know exactly what she was trying to explain. So, I think my time's up. Just to finish, I surrendered to this program on the 18th of April 1990, and I haven't had to use the drug since, so thank you.
Thank you.